And what about writing The War of Art?
It was another book that came like that, you know, it was no problem.
Right. And it's an interesting style that I kind of stole a little bit from my book.
A little? No, I'm just kidding. You know, yours was your own authentic voice.
That's right. Inadvertently, you're funny sometimes. So
yeah, it's not intentional. Yeah. I couldn't do it on demand.
Hi, this is Jeff Seymour, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I interview the prolific Stephen Pressfield, author of The War of Art, Turning Pro, Do the Work, The Legend of Bagger Vance, Gates of Fire, Tides of War. I could go on and on, but let's just get to the interview.
The way I used to work with my agent as a writer, I was a screenwriter at the time, mm-hmm. was before I would start on any project, I'd have a sit down with him, I'd have him read my I'd go in and pitch it to him verbally. Let's say I had two or three ideas, and we'd sit there for like a couple of hours, and I'd pitch him the ideas, and he would say, we can't do that one because 20th Century Fox is already doing something like that, or that idea sucks, or would you change this? And so I would never start anything until I had his enthusiastic approval, you know? So I came in and I told him I had this crazy idea.
So there were definitely times then, I would have to say, that you went in and he said no, and then he just kiboshed it because there was either something
definitely,
else.
Or I'd go in with four things and he'd pick one. You know, which I think is actually a pretty good way to work. Cause
it's excellent. It sounds like some kind of old Hollywood,
yeah,
you know.
Because, I mean, the agent knows the marketplace and knows
right.
what's out there, what's being made already, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I came in there and I pitched him, I said, I've got good news and I got bad news. And the good news is I have an idea I'm totally consumed by and I'm definitely going to do it. And the bad news is it's a book. It's not a movie.
Because you had been writing screenplays.
And so basically he sort of fired me or I fired him. In other words, he very justifiably said, I've been busting my ass for the last 4 years to try to get you out there in the town and have a presence as a screenwriter. And now you're going to tell me you're going to take, you know, what, a year to write a book? You know what? You know, Jeff, what happens to your career if you're gone for a year? Nobody knows who the hell you are, right?
Yes, right. I know
so
that over and over
he
again.
Was really pissed off at me and he wouldn't help me. You know, he wouldn't get it to any agents or anything like that. So we parted company, and I just went ahead and did it. And I thought I was pretty crazy to do it, because who would be interested in a mystical golf story based on the Bhagavad Gita? Who am I going to pitch that to?
I mean, it sounds really stupid
on
paper.
You're out of your mind.
Of course, it really is.
I mean, it sounded stupid to me, too. But I was consumed by it, and so I did it. And the odd thing was, like right now I'm working on a project and I'm on draft 14, whereas Bagger Vance was like draft 1 or draft 3.
It just came right out of you?
And they only changed one sentence in the whole book, and it sold to Jake Eberts and Robert Redford in like 3 weeks, whereas I've never had any success, you know, other than that of my life, you know.
Wow, and they changed
so
one
was,
sentence. It wasn't written by, was it? That wasn't the sentence? Okay, good.
But I didn't even mind. So...
Wow.
Yeah, so that was a real strange phenomenon.
And amazing, great story, and I loved reading the book. And then I was so excited when I heard they're making the movie. And
book is much better than the movie.
I just felt like the bagger had to be, of course, Morgan Freeman. It just had to be Morgan Freeman. When I read it, I thought, this is an older man.
Yeah, it did, exactly.
And Morgan is like godlike, and you know, it would be so, every time I read it, I thought of him. And then, you know, Will Smith, of course, a wonderful actor. But I know at the time you told me that they said they really couldn't have made the film if they hadn't, because the budget was so huge, and that they needed those two names. And at that time, maybe now things would be different with Morgan. You know, you can almost do anything with this guy. But at the time, but at any rate, a great thing. And then I remember I took you flying. I was so impressed and jealous, and I hated you a little bit for your skills. And then
I feel it right now.
Then we went flying, and I remember I took you up to Santa Paula Airport. I hadn't been there too many times, and I lined up on what I thought was a runway, but it was actually some black plastic out on a big field. And as we started to come down lower, you said, yeah, I don't think that's the runway, Jeff.
Really? I forgot all
that. Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. I think you blocked that out of your mind. I remember you got a little nervous, and I thought, you know.
That was terrifying, the whole flight.
That endeared you to me, because I thought, you know, here he is. He's a regular guy. He shits his pants one leg at a time, just like anyone else. Yeah. I thought, you know, and I felt my hatred and, you know, jealousy just subsided. But then it kind of...
Well, you did a great job as a pilot.
Thank you. Once I realized that was a tarp.
Let me say one thing.
Yes,
back
please.
To the story about bagger vans.
Love it.
For those in your podcasting audience who are writers, this overnight success happened after like 35 years of nothing, rejection. So
35 years.
So it was not...
How were you foolish enough to stay in the game for so long?
Because I just...
How is it
you
didn't read the writing?
Like that,
you didn't read the writing on the wall, Steve.
No, I did not. Yeah. Well, what about you? You're still in this game, you know? You've taken the blows.
Oh, my God, have I ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I definitely want to talk about... I want to make the basic subject resistance and really how... how it bled into my philosophy about acting, how it did after I met you, and then reading, of course.
Let me interrupt you to ask you a question.
I would love it.
When I first wrote The War of Art, I thought, well, this is a book for writers, you know? And to my amazement, actors seemed to really respond to it.
Absolutely.
And you know, I've done a couple of classes with actors, you know, where I could really feel the enthusiasm. And to this day, even as we're talking, I always thought, well, why would an actor experience any resistance? It seems like it's so, you get up on stage, you got lines,
so
let me ask you, tell me about why an actor would feel a writer's type of resistance.
Well, I'm definitely going to answer that question because that's really something I want to talk about, so it's excellent. But I just before I do, and we digress into my stuff, I really think it's for anyone, Steve. It's anyone that feels any resistance to get the job at hand done. That's it. And for me, what I got out of The War of Art was at the end of the day, you make these decisions. Well, like one of the quotes in your book, you know, I don't remember the writer, but it was, you know, when do you write? I write when the muse comes to me. And when does the muse come to you? Every morning at 9 a.m.
Yeah, Somerset Maugham,
yeah. I mean, to me, from what I know about you, that's how you run it. That's how you run your writing.
Yeah, which I think just about every writer does. And I guess that's what you mean about the stepping off moment.
You just
for
have
an actor.
To step off, you know? And if you think you're going to get it through making lists or something, I find that is the biggest way people procrastinate, because my observations of the people that are successful in the industry has only been, they didn't seem like geniuses to me as much as they just did what they said they were going to do, and then they kept doing that. I mean, these people I see that run television shows, they just seem like these just people that, I wrote a script, I wrote another one, then I got another one, I wrote another one, and they just never stopped. They did it.
Yeah.
It's this overthinking, overplanning, you know, you even bring that up in writing.
So that's resistance from an actor's point of view.
That is. To me, it is. Uh-huh. It is. Because they think that they're going to get that magic some other way. And I think what actors resist is this idea, and that is, yes, there are things you need to know, but at the end of the day, I think it is a lot easier than you're playing it. You know, it is a lot easier to get where you want to go. I know, having learned from you, like in writing, I don't think I've ever sat down and been inspired. I've maybe had a joke or one scene, and I thought that scene. But, well, gosh, 19 days out of 20, I'd sit down and I'd say, I got nothing.
And I got to give you tremendous credit, Jeff, that I encourage you to write your book about acting, you know, and you just went, sat down and did it, you know, which is like unheard of for me, because I like to psych people up and, you know, support them, and they never do a freaking thing, you know. And, you know, 2 weeks later, you were back, you had the book, you know.
It was good. It was 13
you know?
Weeks.
You didn't really have to change very much at all, you know.
No, it seemed to go, but you know, the story.
You're a rare breed.
Well, the story there was, of course, I'd been trying to write that book for 20 years.
It's like me and Bagger Vance. It was all in your head. It was ready to come.
That's right. And when I'd done a Homeland, and when I was telling you the story, you just said at the breakfast we had, you said, Jeff, you need to write your book. I don't remember ever bringing up that I was going to write a book. I think that's just you kind of saying you need to write a book about your experience in life as a teacher, as a whatever, because of this story I told you about how I was talking to a younger actor. I think that's what prompted you. And I remember leaving there thinking, you know, God, if I don't do it now, I mean, Stephen is, what am I going to say to him next time?
Right. Shame is a powerful motivator.
I'm telling you,
really.
Man.
What am I going to say to him?
I literally went home and I thought, well, that's that. Huh. Steve Pressfield said to me, you're going to write your book.
Well, let me ask you this. After you did your first day and you had whatever you had,
right.
4, 5, 6 pages, did you suddenly say to yourself, shit, I can do this. I just got to keep going.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. I had said I was going to commit. Once I started writing, I just thought, you just got to do this now. And no matter what. I'd written just some scripts and things before, and I'd written my television show.
Mm-hmm.
But to write something so in the ether to me, you know, it's not a story. You're trying to talk to an actor about how to do a thing you can't put your hands on. You know, I found that incredibly difficult. And to address an issue without bringing up any of the past master's methods, to come at something new, I felt was... But once I sat down... Yeah, I was inspired by the fact that, like, you bring up the net at the end of the day and you think, well, there's some nice fish in there. You know, that's really all it is. And I tell writers all the time that sit down, I say, I promise you. Then the next day I sat down, I thought, I got nothing. I said, yeah, Jeff, you said you had nothing yesterday. I'd say to myself, yeah, but that was yesterday. Today I got nothing. And then I'd have something. And then I'd say, Jeff, you said that last 2 days. I go, was it last 2 days? I got nothing. It never ended. But as you say in the book, that if you sit down like a magnet and iron filings just lining up, that's exactly how it would feel. These ideas would kind of just start to, and I'd be shocked at the stuff I'd come up with. At the end of the day, I'd think, well, that makes sense, you know. But then again, of course, the next day I'd be crying.
Well, your unconscious is working while you sleep.
Is that how it works?
And doing that organizing, you know, organizing those thoughts for you. And once you tap into it, there it is.
And so the War of Art, which I had a phone call conversation with you. I remember asking, Steve, what are you working on? You said, I'm doing this little like kind of how-to thingy about writing. I thought, a how-to thingy about writing? I mean, you were so just kind of sketchy in that, yeah, I'm just kind of, you know, kind of a how to, you know. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting, which it became the War of Art. What prompted you to do that?
Well, you'll know this from being an actor. It's like... When you're a working writer, people come to you all the time and they've got a book in them, right? Oh, you know, if I should, my grandmother crossed the prairie, you know, and da-da-da-da, right?
Exactly, sure.
And so I would sit with my friends till like 2 in the morning, trying to psych them up and get them over the hump. Like, you were the only one who ever actually listened to me, you know? And finally, after about maybe 10 of those things, I just said to myself, I'm going to put this shit down on paper. And then the next time somebody comes to me, I'll just put it in their hand and say, here, read this.
Get off my porch.
I won't have to stay up till 2 in the morning since they're never going to do it anything anyway.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was just kind of getting your thoughts together.
It was sort of between books. And
you wrote a series of those books.
Yeah, I wrote a few follow-ups. You know?
Which led to Turning Pro.
Yeah.
Was that the very next one after that?
Yeah.
And what did you fine-tune in that?
The concept of Turning Pro is in the War of Art. It's like part 2 of a 3-part thing, and it's sort of the answer to the question of, well, how do you defeat resistance? How do you defeat self-sabotage?
Right.
And my answer to that was, you change your mindset.
Excellent.
From being an amateur who quits and gives into adversity and, you know, is a weekend warrior and is a lazy bum and doesn't take it seriously.
That's right.
You changed it from that mindset to thinking of yourself as a professional who shows up every day and plays hurt and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And so I thought, let me just focus on that alone for the second book.
Right.
So that was, that was the idea for that.
What is the Warrior's ethos?
The book? That,
yeah.
You mean what is it?
Because I was never gifted that, so I don't really know about it.
You don't know about it?
Yeah, because you never gave me one, Steve.
Oh, sorry.
I see you looking around the house.
I know you could never actually buy a book. It's a long story, but it's more interesting than the actual book. I wrote another book called The Profession that was about, it was a novel set a little bit in the future, and the premise of the novel was that it's sort of coming true now that mercenary armies would take the place of, you know, drafted or conscripted or volunteer armies. You know?
Right.
And to promote that book, my partner, my editing partner, Sean Cohen, and I had this idea. Why don't we write another little book and we'll give it away to the military? And it'll sort of point them a little bit towards this book, The Profession, mainly because we suggested to the publisher, which was Crown Books, many different ways of promoting the book, and they said no to everything, you know? So anyway, the short version is I wrote this book that was just about the warrior ethos, you know, mm-hmm. defining what it is. It's a short book, and it was all composed of anecdotes from the ancient world, stories about of Alexander the Great, of the Romans, of the ancient Greeks, of, you know, and that sort of thing, the Spartans. And we wound up giving away 18,000 copies to the military. The coolest thing was on the back of it, we had this little thing that just had military on the back cover, military edition, not for sale. And it was a kind of a small, it was built to fit in a cargo pocket. And I just wanted to give it to people anyway, because I knew that our guys, because a lot of my stuff is military, and so I hear from a lot of soldiers and stuff, and I knew that one of the maladies that was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan was our guys and gals over there sort of got over there and thought, why am I fighting? You know, I joined up for a certain ideal of what I thought service was and what I thought sacrifice was. And now whatever it is I'm doing here, this doesn't have anything to do with it, you know?
Right.
And they were getting very demoralized. And so this book, The Warrior Ethos, by flashing back to sort of the pure old days of the Spartans and Alexander the Great and da-da-da-da-da, when warfare did contain an element of honor.
And nobility and...
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
That maybe that would remind people, our guys and gals over there in the trenches, and it would, you know, give them a little bit of a lift, you know?
Yeah, I can see how that would be. Yeah,
and
sure.
It did.
Sure,
know?
Which is so anyway, why the military likes...
That's the story of the warrior ethos.
You know, and speaking about that, I know one of the things I wanted to ask you, because you do it so well in your books, it's these battle scenes. These ridiculous battle scenes that go on, and yet... It never feels like it's going on and on. I mean, I'm gripped the whole time. And your descriptions, especially when you're back, you know, with the Greeks having these fights and the minutiae, and, you know, I've accused you many times of course, having lived back then, so we won't bring it up now, but I did. The minutiae of the activities and with the particular, you know, weaponry that they have and how one thing folds into the other. And then when I go back and look how many pages. So my question is, Steve, do you map all that stuff out or do you just put the guy in action and just start?
I just put the guy in action, you know, which I think is
and just
the way
imagine...
an actor would do it too, right?
Sure.
I mean, you just sort of, it's like you say, you jump off the edge of the cliff, right?
Yeah.
In writing. That sort of thing. I think that's really the only... You can't map those things out, I don't think.
Because I know you know that you have, you know, an ability to do that stuff. And in every book that I've read of yours where people start to fight, it is incredible how it keeps going on, but nothing repeats itself. And so the idea
well,
is...
My friends make fun of me about that. It's like, they tell me, well, what are you doing right now today? Are you figuring out another way to stab some guy? You stab him from the right, from the left, or the, you know? But,
I mean,
it's not really that.
The stuff that you think of, like that one heroic gesture by the guy was dying, and he said, you know, put me on your back. So that he would take all the arrows as he walked, got off the field because he was out there. And
really?
There.
I don't even remember that.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a great idea. I'll
yeah.
steal it. It's sort of like being a stunt coordinator, right? And you think of you're choreographing a car chase or a, you know, an action scene or a fight, right?
Right.
Oh, they crash off the roof. They fall down on the lower
right.
roof. Then the fire escape and Jason Bourne falls down and he does this and he does that. You know, I'm sure in the real world from the movies I've been on, and I'm sure you know the same thing, the stunt coordinator makes it up
yes,
in the
right.
moment, right? The writers write these incredible things and they just you know, the movie makers throw it out, and the stunt coordinator says, well, I can't do that. I can't drive a car off a cliff and have it come back in the window, you know, so we're going to have another thing.
Right.
But I can make two cars crash and have one flip over and the other one, you know, so we'll do that.
So this is what you do. Do you ever get on your feet and pretend like you have a sword?
No.
You never sit
I haven't written one of those books in quite a while, so it...
So you don't sit there like with a helmet on.
I can't really remember.
You don't have a helmet on or anything.
No, I don't do that. I usually write in the nude, you know.
And no wonder you live so far up this hill. Okay, now I want to jump back because, you know, part of it's this is to inform and to inspire. And I love
this podcast, you mean?
It is.
Yeah,
it
is. We got to get back to that and help people instead of just shooting the shit here.
Well, no, this is helping people because they realize that, you know, if you work hard enough, then, you know, you can Robert Redford will buy a book.
Yeah.
I know everyone says you lived out of a car, but you lived out of a van. So let's not make it too romantic.
Yeah,
I mean, you could almost stand up in
there. A lot of people lived out of vans. Yeah. A lot of people do right now.
The hardest times. Did you ever think, I'm just going to stop and go do something else?
Well, let me tell you a little slightly different way.
Please.
The way that I kept, that I was able to support myself as while I would write for years and years was I would work in advertising, like in New York, save my money, quit, come out here to California, or go someplace cheap, you know, write a novel for like 2 years. Nobody would buy it. And I'd go crawling back So what would happen each time I would quit is my boss would call me into the office, and they were always usually friends and people who cared about me, and they'd say to me, Steve, what's wrong with you, man? You know, you're going out there again. You're going to, you know, we're worried about you. Stay here, give you a promotion, give you a raise. And I would, you know, go home and say to myself, am I crazy? Why don't I just say yes and take this job, you know? But I just knew, I'm sure you're the same way. You're an actor, you're a director, you're an acting teacher. I just couldn't do it, you know? So take the job, I mean.
Right.
So
and not do the thing that you felt that you had an act for.
Even though I didn't even know why, but I just, but there were, I'm sure this is true for anybody that's done this thing. Probably like 30 moments in my life when I had these conversations with various friends, girlfriends, whatever, you know, where they would plead with me, don't throw your life away, you know? You know,
it would look like you were. I mean,
because really, I mean, they'd say to me, and this would be true, you haven't made a dime. What?
Really?
Why?
Really, Steve?
Yeah, I mean,
made a dime.
Yeah, I started when I first started this. Let me figure this out. 1967 or 68, I quit a job in New York, and I didn't make any money until like 1983, something like that. So how long is that?
16 years. From 67 to 83, that would be 16 years.
Ah.
Okay, but it wasn't a lot of money, was it?
It was a check for $3,500 from Joe Rubin, the director of... I forgot Dreamscape and a couple of other movies. Any options a script of mine. And then I didn't make any money.
But I didn't make any money
for another years after that. Yeah.
Okay, so $3,500.
Yeah.
Well, your friends could still think you were crazy.
Yeah. And I did too. But to go a little deeper, the ancient Greeks had a concept, and I think we've talked about this, called the daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, from which our word demon comes. And the daemon, the translation into Latin, what the Romans called the exact same thing, was the word genius. And the daemon was an inhering spirit that we were born with. And that sort of like a, almost like a an acorn that contains the oak inside
right?
Right?
Mm-hmm. Love it.
And the daemon, I'll tell you a little story here.
Please.
I have a friend named Hermes Melissinidis, who won the gold medal in gymnastics, floor exercise gymnastics, at the 96 Olympics.
Wow.
And when he was 6 or 7, home in Greece, he saw gymnastics on TV for the first time. And he went to his parents and he said, I want to do that. Will you please, you know, sign me up for classes? And he came from a family of doctors. His mother was a doctor. He was a butt, right? And they said, no way you're going to gymnastics. You are going to be a doctor. So he went on a hunger strike. And he...
How old?
7 years old. And for like 4 days, he refused to eat. Finally, his parents caved in. And they said, okay, we'll send you to gymnastics class, but you have to promise you're going to be a doctor too. So he said, okay, I'll do it. And he did. He became a doctor as well, being a gold medalist. But the point of the story is his daemon saw those gymnasts and said, that's you. That's your life.
Wow.
So I think that, looking back, is sort of what propelled me. Of course, I never even heard of that concept until years later.
Sure.
But something wouldn't let me quit when all evidence to the contrary, I should have packed it in, you know, a long time ago.
So you started always wanting to write the great novel. And
you know, I didn't even want that, Jeff. Truly.
You just wanted to write a novel?
And I didn't write when I was a kid. I wasn't an English major. I don't even know how it kind of got started, but I never even believed that I could do it, but I just couldn't stop.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So you started out trying to write novels.
Yeah.
What was the first screenplay then? How did we get the screenplays?
For the first, I started to write, when I had a boss in advertising named Ed Hannibal, who wrote a book, quit the job. He's a really cool guy.
He was called what?
The book was called Chocolate Days, Popsicle Weeks, and it was a hit. He quit his job. He wrote the novel. It was a hit. So I was a young copy cub at Benton & Bowles in New York. I said, well, shit, I'll do that too. So that was it. And then I was finished down a rat hole. So over however long it was, I wrote three novels, none of which were published, none of which came even close. And
Do you have them still?
I do have them still, yeah.
What do you think of them now?
I looked at them, and they're still unpublishable. They did not get any better. But it actually would be, if anybody gave a shit, it would be great to study something that, because there's a lot of good stuff in there, but it's just not publishable. Anyway, then I gave that up. I just said, I just can't do it, you know? I can't do it. And then I came out here to Hollywood, and as a desperation thing, it was that or kill myself.
Okay.
And I wrote 9 scripts on spec over like about 4.5 years.
On spec. Then now, did you have an attachment? Did anybody know you, or were you just writing?
I had an agent.
Okay.
And but I couldn't sell any of them or even came close. And then my agent, Mike Werner, teamed me up with he said, how would you like to write with an experienced writer? He says, you won't be able to do your own thing, but at least you'll be working.
Uh-huh.
So I said yes, and that was sort of what got me, finally sort of got me making actually a paycheck. And that wasn't until like 1985.
Wow.
And then another 10 years before I finally had the idea for Bagger Vance, and I said, okay, let me try another novel.
So you'd say Bagger Vance as the moment where things actually took a turn for you. That's when you kind of graduated.
When I first came out here and I started working, that was a big turn, to actually be working and writing for a living and actually getting paid.
Yeah, because Bagger Vance was more than $3,500 for you. So it was
not
more
much more, but it was a book. It was a real book published by a real publisher.
Yeah, they made a real movie about it.
Yeah.
With real people.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
first screenplay you did that worked, that actually got made, what was it?
you know how it works where you sell them but they don't get made.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I think the first movie I worked on was, might have been Above the Law. You know, the
but
first
that got,
Steven
that got
Seagal.
Made.
Yeah, yeah.
So then you did that. You did King Kong.
Yeah, King Kong
with Jessica Lange.
No. The bad one, the really terrible one with Linda Hamilton.
I didn't
King
even...
Kong Lives. No, I did not do that. The remake of King Kong. No.
Oh.
King Kong Lives. I co-wrote it with my partner Ron.
Ah, King Kong Lives.
That was.
And
the,
I'm assuming.
That was the, yeah.
I'm assuming Linda Hamilton played the girl in it.
Yes.
Okay. And you had a big monkey.
And that was the movie that I don't want to shame my writing partner Ron Shusett, who was a real talent, did Alien, you know, and Total Recall. They were
he wrote those?
Yeah, co-wrote those.
Wow.
But Variety's review of this is in the War of Art of King Kong Lives said Ron Shusett and Stephen Pressfield, we hope these are not their real names for their parents' sake.
Oh, my God.
So.
That's like one of the worst things I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Yeah, yeah. The bottom line of a story like that, or any, I'm sure you've got a million stories like that, yeah, too, is like, and this is my friend Tony Keppelman told me this when I was moaning and groaning him. He says, you're in the arena. You're taking the blows. It's better than being on the sidelines, you know? You'll get better the next time. This is what you wanted, right? This is the life you chose.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. It's a movie, you
That's
know?
It's funny. I always use the phrase with friends and say, hey, nobody put a gun in your mouth and told you to be you, you know?
Yeah.
This was your idea.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that great scene in The Godfather 2 where... He's the acting teacher who played Lee Strasberg played
Lee Strasberg
played whatever
right,
the
right
and who was the guy who was shot in the eye of Las Vegas, the character
Mo Green.
Yeah, he was talking about to Michael Corleone, who he knew pulled the trigger was the right guy, and he said, I heard about Mo Green, this kid, I love this kid. And I didn't ask any questions when I heard about what happened to him. I said to myself, this is the business we've chosen. This is the life we've chosen, you know?
Yes.
And that really rang a bell. I felt chills when I heard that, you know?
Right.
So
now, Steve, if you could possibly finish the latest book that you're on, which is the 35th, how many?
It's like 14, I think, or something like that. Drafts, you mean? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, drafts. Uh-huh.
But it's actually probably more than that, because a lot of times I don't renumber the draft. I just leave it, you know, at draft number 11, and I just write it again.
Right.
You know, but it's a lot of drafts. It's a lot of time.
So you finish that one, and then you're like a Terminator. Then you just go to the next one.
Yeah,
that's what you do.
Yeah, and the ideal way to do it,
uh-huh,
is to know what the next one is before you're done with this one. Mm. Just like an actor or a director, right?
Well,
you want to have your next
yeah
part lined up, right? So that you can just go straight to it.
And how does that come to you?
I'm just sort of always on the lookout in the back of my mind for what's the next one? What's another idea? And, you know, it usually, those things come to you in the shower and stuff like that, right? Which is, so it's good when you're working on Project 11, mm-hmm, that's a good time for Project 12 to pop into your mind, you know? But that's a real mystery. Where do those ideas come from? The muse gives them to you, you know?
Yeah.
Your unconscious or whatever it is talking, and something comes up.
Would you ever want to ever write a screenplay again?
You know, I worked on a screenplay a couple of years ago of a book of mine with my friend Randy Wallace, who did Braveheart. And
yes, heard of him.
So that would be... that's kind of fun to do something from a book that you wrote.
Yeah.
But nobody's going to hire me. I'm on the D list. I'm on the Q list, you know? I don't have any credibility as a screenwriter. So I would never do one from scratch anymore because I have no clout. Nobody's going to read it. Nobody's going to pay attention to it. Plus, I hate the screenwriter's life in that they rewrite you. You know, you're working for somebody else. I would never do that again. Writing screenplays is a lot of fun. But what's terrible about it is when you have to actually deliver it to the producers and the entity that's, you know, the financing entity or whatever, because then they tear it apart, they give you these terrible notes, and you have no power whatsoever.
Have you ever been given good notes?
You see, I'm thinking. I'm sure I have, but it's really painful. You know,
even in my short thing doing it, having had a show, a TV series, a couple of years, but and some other things, I know that it is amazing when someone says something that's actually really, really sharp and like makes your mind go, wow, no, wait, that is a
yeah,
really,
there's not a great note is a great thing.
Yeah, that's
really rare to
it is. And then also someone who knows how to talk to a creative person.
Yeah,
I work with a lady named Sadie Cato at CBC in Toronto, and I remember she knew just how to speak to a creative person and make you feel great while she was giving you
a
note.
It's a really rare thing, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, it is, because most of the time it's silly stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to do it.
You know, I remember when back in my advertising days, they would have these events at, I worked at a really big agency in New York, or a few big agencies, and they'd have these things called gangbangs in the creative department.
Oh, I've heard of those.
When it would be like if you were pitching a new account, like you're pitching 7-Up or Burger King or something.
Right.
And so the whole creative department, which might be 120 people in two-person teams, would come up with commercials and concepts and stuff
like
that.
This was the gangbang.
And you'd have a giant room. You meet in this giant room, and each team would pin up their ideas to the wall and pitch them to the group. And the creative director was there, and he would critique them. And other people were allowed to chime in. And it was very clear to me watching this that even though these were highly paid professional people, award-winning people, out of 50 people, maybe one or two could actually be a good judge. The other people were just getting it completely wrong, you know? And so there are very few people who can give good notes.
Yeah.
That's the truth. I back off on notes because I'm not a good note giver, you know? It's a real talent,
I guess,
to be able to do that. And like you say, to be able to talk to creative people and not destroy their fragile egos, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it is a gift.
What would be the typical listener to the podcast, and what would help them the most?
Well, the typical listener here is they're definitely in the business in some way, because I have writers and directors and certainly actors who listen. I mean, the idea of the podcast was to certainly inform, but also inspire, in the sense that I just want to always talk about people's successes, you know. I think it's interesting for people to hear, you know, like you saying how many years you had to go, how people were constantly talking you out of it, you know. I know it brings me comfort when I think about the people that worked for so many years, and it's important to know because you don't know what it is. And I think we are distracted by the people that come out here and, you know, it's like winning a lottery ticket. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a sad mentality these days. I know when we were kids, the biggest amount of money you could win was the $64,000 question.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
There were no lotteries.
Man, you're old.
Yeah. There was no other way that this could happen, right?
Yeah.
And then as things have changed now with the way social media has gone, anyone from any class in society can become not just rich, but like a billionaire. And they do it in ways that people perceive to be, well, they did some rap songs, they figured out how to do this. So I find that from when I was a kid, and, you know, people were happy to have a job and they worked hard and they made sure that the floor was clean, you know, in their job, and they were very attentive when you went to the business. Now everyone's just kind of staring out the window thinking, how can I get a billion dollars?
Yeah.
And they see the lifestyles of the rich and famous. I mean, all of these distractions weren't around when I was a kid. They just weren't there.
Yeah.
So I think we have a lot of people out there that don't know about hard work and the fact it could take a long time.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm trying to think of what would help somebody that's in that position.
Please.
And that when you see an overnight success, if you dig in a little deeper, you see that that person has been preparing for that overnight success for a long, long time, you know,
right.
And that they were thoroughgoing professionals before it happened, you know.
Right.
And, you know, if you think you want to be a doctor, you don't immediately think, well, let me start performing brain surgery with a penknife in my pocket, right?
Right.
You understand. Or if you want to be a musician, you understand. You got to play that violin, you know, 80,000 hours. Well, why does anybody think that they can become an actor, you know, or write a hit song or something like that? Because there are those one in a million successes, these YouTube sensations and stuff like that, which are like the worst example to follow of all.
Of course, because what it does, it makes you think that if you buy a lottery ticket, you can win.
Yeah.
You know, and you're not preparing yourself for anything.
Yeah.
I know I just did a podcast about the idea that, you know, from when I grew up, you went to schools. So they were going to keep you out of the business at least for 2, 3, 4 years. Now, you know, just people with a little YouTube thing, they want to go and work. And I say, yeah, you know, in a controlled environment, you might have done a very nice job. But it's a different kettle of fish when you walk into rooms and suddenly the pressure's on. You got live rounds going over your head, you know.
Yeah.
And once you blow it in front of people, you've burned that bridge. You know, I drew the parallel to a kid getting out of high school and trying to get in the NBA. I mean, he could have all the skills in the world. Yeah. But those 4 years of college that really kind of get him set in his ways, because it's not, can I do it? It's, can I do it under fire? Can I do it over and over again?
Can I do it on demand?
Can I do it on demand? Can I do it after having been rejected six times? Then on the seventh, can I do it? You know, this is the stuff people really need to pay attention to. If the podcast had any usefulness, I would like it to be a recurring theme of, man, you just got to put in the work. You know, and the byproduct.
And who says that the work is not fun?
It's kind of
your
fun.
Life, you know.
It's the byproduct. It's great. Of it is the jobs that you get to do, but you've got to. I mean, I know it's an old saying, but you got to really love the process. You have to. I mean, the job of acting is really getting jobs. It's not the work.
Yeah,
the work's
yeah.
just fun stuff. You put on makeup and run around and get to make faces, and it's a delight. It's it's a kid's game. It's lovely, but the work is just. I mean, when people ask me, what are you most proud of in all my years, now 38, I immediately say, I'm still here. That's it. I'm still here.
Thing. Yeah, it's true, Jeff.
You know, I'm standing up straight. Yeah. I'm happy.
Yeah.
I'm okay. And because when I look back. And
you look sensational.
Well, thank you. I've got a good face for radio. That I look back to the people I graduated with. I mean, there's like maybe two of us that are still in the business.
Yeah.
You know, the attrition
rate
is incredible. And it's all about. And this is it. You know, I was doing a podcast about the idea that, you know, we say, you know, it's not that it's hard. It's not that it's impossible. I say, bring that stuff on, man. Let's do that. I'm not afraid of that. No, it's the soul crushing aspect of the business. That is why people say, if you can do anything else, do it. It's the stuff that you can't even imagine. It's not the heavy lifting. It's not, oh, look at that big hunk of rocks. I got to move them from there to there. Yeah. It's not that. It is this stuff that gets you in the middle of the night at 4 a.m. It wakes you up and shakes you right to your bone and says, I don't know, kid, this is looking pretty gloomy. You know, overcoming that every day. And it's lonely. I don't care if you have a support group. You still go back to your house.
There's no such thing as support. Yeah,
no,
right.
You go back, you're alone, you stand there, you wake up at night when you go to bed.
And those are the things that nobody sees, you know? Yeah. There's that... that great song they always play at the NBA Finals, One Shining Moment, and one of the lines is something like, you know, all those years that you put in, and now it shows, you know, in the finals of the NBA.
Right.
And that's all those years, that's the actor's life, and that's the writer's life.
Right.
And like you say, it's those lonely, those moments, those girlfriends, those divorces, those, you know,
it is,
and you're asking yourself, why am I doing this? But you do it because you don't have a choice.
And it is incredibly volatile. It's a very volatile business. People don't understand that. I mean, the way they're turning over, you know, talent and everything. I say it has this business has no compassion for you.
Yeah,
it has no empathy for the actor. It is none. This business is a sociopath when it looks at you. It doesn't care about you.
True.
And I don't mean it in a bad
way. But every business is like
that,
you know?
It's got the bottom line. They're not going to look into your soul. They don't give a shit. If you can put money in their pocket through some way, you've got their attention. And if that ever wanes, it's nothing personal, Sonny. It's business. Yeah. You got to go away.
On the other hand, I'm going to finish with two positive thoughts.
Please.
One is, you look at what's on TV today, which is where a lot of the action is, and there's like so many of these kind of series that, you know, 8 episodes or whatever, that there's work for actor after actor after
and they're
actor.
Some amazing
and some
stuff.
Of them are just incredible.
Yes.
I'm watching, actually, my next door neighbor right there is Davey Holmes, who wrote is the showrunner or the producer, executive producer of Get Shorty, the Get Shorty thing.
Oh, now that's happening.
Have you watched that?
No.
I'm going to tell you, there's everybody's great on it, but there's one female actress, a Latino female actress who plays this kind of Ma Barker, you know, type of gangster. And you never saw her before anywhere. I can't even know what her name is. She's fantastic. She's like incandescent. She's just, you know, so it is possible. And meanwhile, all of that minor actors are great too. You know, people you never even saw them in bit roles, and they're great. So there is, you know, light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, there is.
But of course, beyond that is what's the next job and the next job and the next job. You got to make it a career. But here's one other thing I want to say and see if you agree with me. Thinking of our two original friends, Ram and Donna, when we first met, Rahm is now a big successful producer doing the next Star Wars movie, whatever it is.
He did it. It's already in the can, okay. Star Wars 8. Him and Kathleen Kennedy.
Wow. So he was like a punk producer. Well, I don't know even what he was.
It was his
he
first
was
job.
Cups of coffee for
he
people,
was his
right?
first job with me doing it. That's the first time he'd produced anything. And now he's unbelievable.
And Donna, who sort of chose the life, chose to get married and have kids.
Yes.
She's still working. She's producing movies. She's directing movies. She's writing scripts. You know.
That's right.
So this is my sort of, tell me if you agree with this, at least in the movie business. If you're willing to put in, to come out here and commit full tilt for 10 years, pretty much anybody that does that finds a place. Mm-hmm. It might not be the place they dreamed of. You know, they might have wanted to be Robert Redford and they wind up being, you know, a cinematographer or you know, whatever, something other than that.
Right.
They might be God forbid, they might be a writer, you know?
Yeah.
But it does seem like, although the odd, you know, what happens is over those 10-year period, 9.99999% drop out.
That's right.
So if you're still here, you know,
that's
and
it.
You're willing to.
I think it is. Well, that, you know, they say it's a marathon and not a sprint. And, you know, I did a podcast on the idea of equilibrium, I call it. You know, if you want to be in this business, you've got to reach equilibrium, meaning you've got to get to a place where you can support yourself to a degree that is acceptable for you, whatever that is for you. That can't be a part of your constant grind.
True. True.
Because you cannot.
But you can do that.
And you can do it. You can find a way to do it, whatever that is. For some people, it's like living in a van, and I'm okay with that. For some people, it's not. I got to have a two-bedroom house. Whatever that is, you've got to find it. Find a way to make that happen. Because I think to be in the business, there's enough grinding going on. You can't worry about everything.
True. You're right. Yeah.
And if you do that, then you're living your life. It's decent. You're able to just have the basic things. You can smile every day. And then hack away at this industry. But my observations have been that the people that stick to it, that do the work, that get it done, to some degree or another, they find a way in enough to where the people that have fallen away, I think it was more attitude than talent. Because I've seen a lot of talented people fall by the wayside.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Way more than the people that you know didn't have talent. Those people really never get started. It's the people that had the talent just couldn't navigate the rough seas of being in this business. They just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all perspective. It's all perspective on how you look at things, on how you address things.
It's attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's always been, don't take it personally.
Yeah.
You know,
that's professionalism.
That's it. It's not personal. It is the deal. That's it. But listen, I've been wanting to ask you about this. What is this here?
Well, this is a book that it's pretty recent with me. It's called The Knowledge, and it's like, it's really my true story of struggling in New York when I was driving a cab and all that sort of stuff. Well, highly fictionalized, but it's, and if I can find a thing here, I just want to read this.
I would love for you
this to. Thing if I can find it. So this is from a real life novel that's called The Knowledge, and it's a. It's talking about, it's in my voice. I'm the guy that's talking this. And it's talking about my agent. And in real life, my agent in the book was named Marty. And in real life, I had an agent named Bart Fless, who was about 90 years old. but was a real old-time, wonderful guy. And so this is his philosophy, if I can.
I love it. Please.
Marty is a death camp survivor. He's got the tattoo. He never speaks about the experience directly. I only know through my friend Pablo, who originally introduced me to Marty. But he'll make remarks from time to time whose gist is, appreciate life, never complain, work hard, and do your best. Marty has one other mantra. Talent is bullshit. Quote, I've seen a million writers with talent. It means nothing. You need guts. You need stick-to-itiveness. It's work. You got to work. Do the fucking work. That's why you're going to make it, son. You work. No one can take that away from you. And I'll tell you something else, Marty says to me now over the phone. Appreciate these days. These days when you're broke and struggling, they're the best days of your life. you're going to break through, my boy. And when you do, you'll look back on this time and think this is when I was really an artist, when everything was pure and I had nothing but the dream and the work. Enjoy it now. Pay attention. These are the good days. Be grateful for them.
Oh, that's perfect.
That's all I have to say on the subject.
I love it, and let's leave it at that. That was great. Thank you so much for this
pleasure,
today.
Okay, my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you. Thanks for coming up and thinking up these questions.
My pleasure. You have been listening to a Real Life Actor podcast. This is Jeff Seymour. Please follow us on Podomatic or subscribe on iTunes. And don't forget to pick up Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art. And while you're at it, order a copy of The Real Life Actor. I mean, why wouldn't you? Thanks for listening.